Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm your host for the show.
Monarch butterflies, we've covered this in the past, how they're endangered, but how are we doing on this? We'll get the latest numbers and learn about what you can do to help restore the population of these beautiful insects. There's a huge untapped potential for cities for generating energy, and we're talking millions of gigawatts here. With all those residential rooftops, they could go solar. We'll find out how cities can make it easier for everyone.
All coming up on this week's edition of Green Sense. Monarch butterfly population has declined more than 80% in the past 20 years, and the latest numbers aren't very encouraging. What does the monarch population tell us about the state of food safety? What could it mean if we lose this species? And what can we do to make sure the monarch population becomes healthy again? Bill Fries is science policy analyst with the Center for Food Safety, and he joins us now on Green Sense. Welcome, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Robert.
Bill, what's the connection between food safety and a butterfly population? I can't see the connection, so I'm interested to hear.
Well, you know, it's really an interesting phenomenon. The monarch butterfly depends very strongly on milkweed, this plant that I think we all know. It's the only plant that they can breed on. And it turns out that the Midwest is a really important area for them to breed in during the summer. And what's happened is ever since the mid to late 90s, there's been this huge change in agriculture with these new crops that are resistant to an herbicide, Roundup, that your listeners may know of. And it turns out that Roundup, and the technical name is glyphosate, happens to be incredibly effective at killing milkweed. And a lot of the milkweed that monarchs used to depend on lived in farm fields, right? So there's been almost an extermination of milkweed from these farm fields, and that's a big part of monarch decline. Also, this herbicide has some real, you know, public health implications. It was 2 years ago, it was designated a probable human carcinogen by the world's, you know, cancer experts. At the World Health Organization. So this is a great example of where something we really love in nature, when it is hurting, it can also have implications for us, for human beings.
So, Bill, I understand the connection between the milkweed and the monarchs, but where's the connection between monarchs and food safety?
I mean, I think I was trying to spell it out there a little bit with, you know, you have excessive use of, you know, herbicides, and in particular this Roundup, and that decimates the milkweed that monarchs depend upon. It turns out, though, that if you use so much of this herbicide, you know, for farmers in particular who use it, it's a real hazard to their health. It can, you know.
So the hazard comes to the farmers, but is it also impacting our food supply because we're getting excessive amounts of pesticides on it? Is that the connection?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we should, when we talk about public health, farmers are also people, and we need to value them as well, of course.
Sure.
And, it's just, I think we often kind of don't look at that, you know, strongly enough. But yeah, it turns out that there's also more of this herbicide in the food supply as a result of this massive use of Roundup. And, you know, there are other pesticides, too, that are concerning. that sure. could be impacting monarchs.
And we've covered this issue, and I think the pesticide issue in our food supply is pretty well documented. And I think many of us feel that even better than organic is having pesticide-free produce. So I think that point is well illustrated. So your new report shows that monarch habitat is down by 2.48 hectares from 2.91 hectares last winter. And for those metric impaired in the audience, 1 acre equals 2.4 hectares. Why is that significant?
Well, you know, it's actually what's more significant is the trend. You see a lot of annual fluctuations that are caused by, you know, specific weather events this year that, you know, temperatures can be bad for monarchs, say, in the, you know, in the summer. If it's too hot, that's not good for them. The real issue is the 20-year trend. There have been very, very good counts of monarchs for 20 years, and it's about a 90% decline over just a 20-year period. And if you think about that, for your listeners who know of, like, passenger pigeons, for instance, which went extinct decades ago, this is an incredibly rapid decline of a population. And in fact, scientists have estimated that there's up to a 57% chance that monarchs the monarch migration will collapse if, you know, we don't do something and do something, you know, seriously.
My guest is Bill Fries, the science policy analyst with the Center for Food Safety. And we're talking about the connection between the monarch butterfly and our food supply. We've covered this topic several times, but remind us, what might happen to the ecosystem if we lose the monarch butterfly? And as you said, with the trend of a 90% decrease in population, it looks like we're headed that way.
Yeah, you know, it's always difficult to predict exactly, you know, what will happen or what will be the broader impacts. I think, just back up a bit. In 2014, we teamed up with other groups and the world's leading monarch scientists to file a petition with the Fish and Wildlife Service to have monarchs declared a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And, you know, so basically we want action to protect the monarch, but it's actually whenever you have, you know, practices which are harming one species, you're almost certainly harming others as well. Monarchs are pollinators, and there are other pollinators that are threatened by the excessive pesticide use in conventional farming systems, and especially with GMOs. GMOs have really exacerbated the problem of pesticide and especially the herbicide, the weed killer use.
Why has GMOs exacerbated the problem?
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't know, but the vast majority of GMOs are engineered to be resistant to weed killers or herbicides, which are one form of pesticide, by the way. So basically, you know, an herbicide that previously had to be used very carefully because they're plant killers, right? So they can hurt crops as well as kill weeds. So they had to be used carefully in the past, but now through genetic engineering, they make the crops actually resistant to the herbicide, and that means it can be used much more freely, more intensively later in the season, right, without fear of harming the crop, right? So we're seeing a big increase in use and of these herbicides, and they're being used later in the season. One of the impacts of the huge increase in Roundup use has been that weeds have become resistant to this herbicide. This is a massive problem. And what's the response of the biotech companies? Well, they're starting to engineer new crops that are resistant not only to Roundup, but to additional herbicides so that they too can be sprayed much more intensively. And, you know, so it's really, we're on this toxic spiral, you might call it, or people have used the term pesticide treadmill, where you have resistance evolving to one, you know, weed killer that's used. And then the response is not to pull back, right, and be more sparing in our use of these chemicals, but to double down.
Well, let's take
absolutely the wrong way to go.
Well, what about the argument that reducing pesticides means a drop in food production? You know, we are probably one of the most efficient when it comes to food production, and a lot of that is through chemistry. Can we still have high crop yields and not harm the butterfly population?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. That whole argument is much overblown. The fact is that there are many ways to manage weeds that don't involve massive use of herbicides. And organic farmers have worked out a lot of this over decades. It involves simple things like rotating crops, having a diverse crop rotation, because that weeds, you know, do better in particular crops. So if you mix it up over time, that can really help. You can plant cover crops in the off season, and that can also be a way to suppress weeds when, you know, during the main crop season. So there are lots of ways to radically reduce herbicide use, or in the case of organic farming, pretty much eliminate it without, you know, reductions in crop yields. That's largely a myth.
The argument out there too is that there's such a small percentage, less than 10% of all produce is produced through organic farming. And organic farming has its issues. You know, people put that on a pedestal, but it does use different types of pesticides. So it's not always, you know, as pristine as people may think. The other thing that you're recommending out there, which I think is a simple thing that we can all do, is encourage just everyday people to plant milkweed in their gardens to help the butterfly population. Has this been helpful?
Yeah, you know, I think it's wonderful, all of the volunteer efforts across the country to plant more milkweed in natural areas. And I think it's an important part of the picture to try to bring the monarch back. But I would argue that if we don't also address agriculture, then it's going to be very, very difficult to bring the monarchs back.
And to that point, there's very big forces out there. There's large corporations with billions of dollars that are supporting this. How do you combat these big agro giants that are making these pesticides and herbicides?
Yeah, it's a real struggle, but this is kind of what we do every day. It's a big part of what we do, at least. And one thing is, we have lawyers on staff, and we'll, you know, challenge the regulatory agencies like the EPA when they make bad, wrong decisions. So, you know, EPA has basically just kind of rubber stamped whatever Monsanto and the other big companies want, right, in terms of these GMOs and the herbicides that are applied to them. So we've, you know, sued EPA to try to reverse some of these decisions. And we're in the process right now of challenging a couple of new GMOs on that score. We also, you know, do public education, just try to get the word out to average folks to get them active. And, you know, we have action alerts at centerforfoodsafety.org. So, yeah, if any of your listeners are interested, they could definitely check us out.
So I thought we learned a long time ago that litigation and confrontation only prolongs issues. Buckminster Fuller, you know, once said that if you want to change the status quo, create a new model that makes the old model obsolete. So what can we do with these big corporations to get them to spend their money in a positive way to the environment rather than litigating on these issues?
Yeah, you know, well, that's a you know, a big question, of course. And companies like Monsanto, they make their living now from selling these high-tech GMO seeds and herbicides. So I think it's a long shot to expect them to change their practices. I think we need to, you know, as consumers, buy sustainably produced food, and organic is one good option for that. And the other thing we've worked a lot on is to have labeling of GMOs or foods that contain GMOs, and that allows folks to have a choice, you know, in the marketplace. And I think we can, you know, definitely we've had an impact at, you know, if you look at the markets for like organic crops, they've been growing tremendously, organic foods. So I totally agree with you. We need to shift the paradigm, but I also think we do need to fight the giants and try to, you know, do our best to limit and reverse the damage that's been done.
Bill, thanks for joining us on Green Sense, and keep up the fight.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
That's Bill Fries, science policy analyst with the Center for Food Safety. This is Robert Colangelo, and a reminder to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast. Visit greensensefarms.com. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you. Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Cities continue to be the driving force when it comes to more sustainable ways to generate energy. Solar energy presents a great untapped potential for cities, and a new report from Environment America provides the top 10 ways for cities to go solar. Emma Saracens, part of the Go Solar campaign with Environment America, and she joins us on Green Sense. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me.
As your report tells us, the 20 cities generating the most solar power now generate nearly 2 gigawatts, enough power to light up almost 400,000 homes. That seems pretty small with as much interest and as long as renewable energy has been out there. Any idea how much could be generated?
Yeah, you're totally right. Solar has been growing really rapidly in cities across the country, but there's still so much untapped potential here. And it's actually hard to come up with an estimate, but what we do know is that the majority of U.S. cities could actually generate at least 50 times more solar power than they currently do from distributed solar panels on small rooftops alone. And then on top of that, they can go much further with installations on large buildings and utility-scale installations as well.
Well, that's an incredible untapped potential. What is the major impediment from implementing that?
Yeah, we find that in many ways, it is policies and local actions and state actions as well that just don't set up city governments themselves to lead by examples and city residents to actually take action and install solar on their own homes and businesses.
Well, let's take a look at some of the guidelines in the report, and maybe you could shed some renewable light on it. One of them is to set ambitious goals for solar energy adoption. Can you give some examples?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the examples that we point to in our new guide is San Diego. The city has one of the highest installed solar capacities in the whole country, and they have a broader goal of actually generating 100% of all their electricity from renewable sources. And solar energy makes up a huge part of their plan to achieve that goal, and a number of other cities model that approach as well. But then others have also set standalone solar commitments. So places like Philadelphia, which set a solar goal of reaching 20,000 solar roofs by 2025, and a few others as well.
Is San Diego so high because the sun shines a lot there, or is it because utility rates are high and people are looking for a lower cost alternative?
Great question. It's a little bit of both, actually. So a lot of cities have the potential to catch up with places like San Diego, even if they receive a whole lot less sun. Although I do think it helps encourage people when they know that their solar panels will be so effective. But you're right, the local energy market in San Diego also really encourages folks to go solar because it's so cost competitive. And then additionally, both the city and the state have a bunch of policies and incentives in place that encourage, on top of that cost saving, folks to go solar as well.
Well, another point you have here is develop and publicize local financing options. Well, financing is critical to any project. So tell us a little bit more about how that can be effective.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most popular options for a local financing program is called Property Assessed Clean Energy Program, or PACE. It's commonly used at the local and state government level, and it's a program where cities or states can loan money to homeowners or business owners, and then those homeowners or business owners can repay it over time through their property taxes. But cities can also get creative and work outside of the PACE space. We've also seen some work with local banks and credit unions to offer low-interest loans for solar projects, and that can be really successful as well.
I'm talking with Emma Sirison with Environment America about their Go Solar campaign to get cities to use more solar power. Well, here's another one, Solarize Your City. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I think we're all pretty familiar with the power of bulk purchasing in our daily lives, things like group health insurance policies and shopping at Costco are ways that everyone is familiar that can save you money. And that all applies when you're buying solar energy too. So Solarize programs are bulk purchasing programs that businesses, homeowners, and nonprofits can go in together and purchase solar energy collectively, and it just makes it more affordable for everybody. So we actually, Environment America, helped establish one in Athens, Georgia, and it helped more than triple residential solar capacity in the metro area within 5 months. So we know they can really be effective.
Well, as Americans, we know about buying in bulk, so I think that would take shape pretty quickly. Well, this one's
Absolutely. Easy
to say but hard to do, and if you could do it, maybe you should be president. Eliminate red tape in government. Now, how are you going to do that?
Absolutely. We do see that as a huge challenge for a lot of governments, but it's also a really important one, since with solar energy particularly, the soft costs, the things that are associated with zoning or permitting but not the hardware itself, actually make up the majority of the cost for a residential system. So cities can reduce their fees, they can make permitting rules clear and simple and available online, and they can also expedite their permitting processes. And luckily, there are actually some free technical assistance programs out there to help out. We really recommend the Department of Energy's SolSmart program, which is one of those free technical assistance programs that also offers designation for cities who are successful.
Well, here's one that's counterintuitive. Partner with utilities. I never understood why utilities want to have renewable energy projects that cut into their coal-based power sources. So explain that one, why partnering with utilities is good.
Sure. I think a lot of people feel that way. We tend to think that utilities are the natural enemy when it comes to renewable energy. But that doesn't always have to be the case. There are many cases in which it's in a utility's long-term best interest and the people's best interest to do more renewable energy. So we've seen some municipal, some cooperative, and even some investor-owned utilities partner with city governments to offer things like community solar projects that are beneficial to folks at home and help the utility have a more resilient and more consistent energy supply. And cities also have the option, if there is a situation in which a utility is not a willing partner, some cities have municipalized those utilities, and that can allow them to have even greater control over their electric grid.
Have you heard from any city leaders about these guidelines? Are they willing to give them a try?
Yeah, definitely. We have been connecting with cities all over the country throughout the year. both recommending the SoulSmart program, which has grown hugely. It's now now has over 180 designated communities across the country. And we've been working with a handful of cities to actually set really ambitious solar energy goals. So that is really exciting. And another part of my work with Environment America is our Mayors for Solar Energy initiative. We've, through that, spoken with dozens of elected officials and municipal staff from cities of every political background and shape and size. And so many are excited about a renewable energy future and want to take action.
Again, another counterintuitive situation I see out there is that a lot of Western state utilities seem to be really pushing against solar and renewable energy. Any thoughts or comments there where the Western states have so much sun? How do we get more solar projects going out that way?
Yeah, you're right. There is a lot of missed opportunity in sunny places where the politics or the utility politics especially might be challenging. And in those cases, we really encourage cities to actually use their voice in those situations. So governors and state legislators and the bodies that regulate our utilities all care about what mayors and city councils and, you know, generally their elected bodies think. And cities have a great opportunity to actually speak up and advocate for things that help them go solar, like really good renewable electricity standards and net metering policies and comprehensive solar rights policies that can help us address that issue.
Emma, thanks for joining us on GreenSense, and good luck with your efforts.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Emma Searson with the Go Solar Campaign with Environment America. This is Robert Colangelo with GreenSense, and remember to subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's show. What are we going to learn next week, Bob?
Solar energy, as we've been talking about on this show, is great, but one thing it can't quite do is store the energy from the sun. You either use it or lose it. Maybe until now, we'll meet a scientist from Boston College who might have figured out how to store solar energy.
Stay fresh, listeners. Keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.